I'm going to start off with an example, which is the Speckens toy theory by Rob Speckens from Perimeter Institute here. It's a good example which illustrates a lot of the features that you could have, illustrates the way that a lot of seemingly puzzling phenomena could be accounted for by an underlying realist theory. Then I'm going to move on to the more formal part where we define what we mean by one of these models and give some of the main examples, these toy examples. Okay, so let's start with this Speckens toy theory. The aim of the toy theory was to try and show how many quantum phenomena which seem weird could be easily accounted for by a psi epistemic local and non-contextual model. Later on this week, we'll see the precise definitions of these words, but roughly speaking, the idea here is we want to think of the quantum state as being something like a probability distribution over some underlying states of reality. Now, there's a sophisticated way to develop this formalism, which is to develop it in terms of a discrete phase-space theory. That's done in this paper here. Because I don't have time to go into that in a huge amount of detail, I'm going to stick to the original presentation, which will give you the basic idea, but does have a few deficiencies. Some versions of this theory do reproduce full sub-theories of quantum theory. So if you take continuous variable degrees of freedom, and you restricted attention to Gaussian states, measurements and operations. I'm not going to define exactly what those are, but you know, you probably are roughly familiar with the idea of a Gaussian state at least. Then that sub-theory of quantum theory is fully reproduced by this theory, the continuous variable version. And there's also something called stabilizer quantum theory in odd prime dimensions. If you've taken quantum information courses, you may know what the stabilizer formalism is. It doesn't quite do that in the simplest version of the theory. So the simplest version of the theory is the theory of toy bits, which I'm going to describe today. This is analogous to quantum stabilizer formalism for qubits, but it doesn't exactly reproduce that part of quantum theory. It can't do partly because we know that part of quantum theory is contextual, as we will see later on this week. Okay, so this theory is based on the following idea, which is to impose an epistemic restriction on how much you can know about a physical system. Okay, so the physical system has some underlying state of reality, but there's some restriction on how much we can know about it. Somehow analogous to something like the uncertainty principle here. So roughly speaking, what this principle says is that in a state of maximal knowledge, when you know as much as you possibly can about the system, then you know as much about it as you don't know. Okay. So let me formalize that a bit more. Okay, so let's take the simplest case. Suppose we have a system that has four possible ontic states, four possible states of reality, and call that system a toy bit. So we can think of the possible states of reality as corresponding to four squares here, and I've labeled the ontic states by a plus and minus symbols, right? So if you think of this as the y-axis and this is the x-axis, this says you're in the positive x quadrant, positive y quadrant, positive x quadrant, negative y quadrant, etc. Right, so that's how I'm labeling those four states. Okay, so now we can ask ourselves, if you're only allowed to ask yes-no questions, what's the minimum number of yes-no questions, binary questions, needed to determine what the exact ontic state is if you don't know anything? Well, the answer to that's two. So there's several ways of doing it. One is I could say, okay, is it up here or down here? Right, that's one binary question. And once I know the answer to that, I can ask, is it on the left or the right? Okay, so I need a minimum of two such questions. Yeah.
But that's exactly if and because the measurement observables of the two entries do not commute.
There's no non-commutativity here. Everything's like, these
That's
are classical
my point.
state.
If there's no commutativity, then we should know everything.
In principle, if it was a classical system, you should know, you could know everything. But here, we're just imposing as a principle, we don't know where it comes from yet, that that just that we don't. There is this restriction. Something's hidden. Of course, you would want to derive why that's the case if you were thinking of this as a full physical theory, but we're not. We're thinking of it as a sort of toy example. Okay, so then what I mean by this is that you know the answer to precisely half of those questions, and you're completely uncertain about the answer to the other half of those questions. So in this case, we know the answer to one binary question that divides this ontic state space in half, and then you're completely uncertain about the answer to the other one. Okay, so there are six epistemic states, by which I mean probability distributions describing our knowledge, that are compatible with that knowledge balance principle, right? So depending on which binary question you ask, right? So if I ask, is it on the left or the right, then I have two states where I know the answer to just that question and nothing else. And by this blue here, I mean probability a half, right? So squares that are filled in blue have the same probability, and they have probability a half. So I know that the state's on the right, but I don't know, about, and it has probability zero of being on the left, but I don't know whether it's the top or bottom one. So similarly, if I ask, is it on the bottom or the top question, and that's the one I know the answer to, I get these two states, and there's one more binary question, I could say, is it on this diagonal or that diagonal, and that gives me these two states. So I've suggestively labeled these states in a similar way to quantum spin eigenstates. I'm using a curly ket because these are classical probability distributions, not quantum states. But you can think that these things are roughly analogous to those spin eigenstates that you would have in quantum theory. So the knowledge balance principle said in a state of maximal knowledge. Of course, I can also have less than maximal knowledge, and there'll be one other state in the theory, which is a state of non-maximal knowledge, which is just the equal mixture of all four possible ontic states. So this light blue means probability a quarter. You might say, why is this the only mixed state that I can have? Well, there will be a principle, which I won't go into in detail, which is that we want also there to be a sort of church of the larger Hilbert space picture here. So when we talk about composite systems, this kind of state here should be the marginal of some pure state on a, well, in the sense that I'm thinking of these as like pure states, of some pure state on a larger system. And when you do that, you'll find that actually this is the only other state you can have. Okay, so measurements. So for measurements, we're gonna demand two principles. One is that they should be repeatable. So if I make a measurement, and then I make the same measurement immediately again, I want to get the same answer. And the second principle is that they shouldn't violate the knowledge balance principle. Okay, so after learning the outcome of a measurement, I shouldn't end up in a state where I know more than half the answers to more than half the questions. So this immediately tells you that measurements have to be coarse-grained, because if there was a measurement that revealed the exact ontic state, right, that told me, for example, which of these four squares I'm in, then suppose I get the outcome that's in this square, then the only possible epistemic state probability distribution that would be repeatable would be to have probability one here, right, because every other ontic state would give me a different answer if I repeated the measurement. So that would necessarily have to leave me in a state which isn't valid, which violates the knowledge balance principle. So you can't have a measurement which gives you perfect, fine-grained information about the state of reality. But you can have measurements that reveal coarse-grained information, provided they also disturb the ontic state in some way. So let's see why that's the case. So let's consider what I'm going to call an x measurement. X measurement has two outcomes, plus or minus one. If the system is on the left here, it gives me minus one. If it's on the right, it gives me plus one. Now let's consider what happens if I take this plus y state where I'm on the top. Suppose you get the plus one outcome. Then, since you knew that the system was either here or here, you know that before you did the measurement, the system must have actually been in this box. So now you know that the system's exactly here. But that would violate the knowledge balance principle. So the only way I can do this and preserve the knowledge balance principle is to imagine that the act of doing this measurement, for whatever reason, disturbs the state of reality. Okay, so if this measurement is going to be repeatable, then I have to end up in one of these two boxes. So if we imagine that when I find this outcome, what actually happens is that with probability half, nothing happens to the system, and with probability half, these two states get swapped, then what will happen? Then after I learn that I'm in the plus one outcome, I will go from this state to this epistemic state. So basically, I first learn that I'm over here, and then with probability a half, these two get switched. So all in all, I end up in this state. But you need to have that disturbance of the underlying state in order to preserve the knowledge balance principle in time. Okay, so with those restrictions, these are the possible sort of pure states of the theory, and these are the possible measurements that you can have. And just as in quantum theory, these things act as eigenstates for this measurement, in the sense that the epistemic state uniquely determines the outcome of this measurement and stays the same after I do that measurement. Now, bear in mind that the epistemic state, the probability distribution, is staying the same, but the underlying ontic state doesn't, right? What happens when I do an x measurement here is that either these stay the same or get flipped with 50-50 probability, so the underlying ontic state changes randomly, but the probability distribution is invariant under that if you're in one of these eigenstates. Okay. Now, dynamics. So let's consider the analog of unitary dynamics. It should be reversible. If it's going to be reversible, then it basically has to be a permutation. So the analog of unitary dynamics is just a permutation of the underlying ontic states. And then you can just compute what that will do to the epistemic states. So for example, if we move the ontic states around in a circle like this, then over here, you say, okay, well, this ontic state's going to go there, that ontic state's going to go there, so this probability is going to become this probability distribution. Okay. So then you can work that out for any permutation, how that acts on the epistemic state space. All right, so now composite systems. So let's consider two toy bits. So each toy bit is going to have its own ontic state, right? So these two degrees of freedom for each of the toy bits. Okay, it's going to have the plus or minus x, plus or minus y degree of freedom for toy bit A and toy bit B. So each of those state spaces has four degrees of freedom. So in total, there are 4 times 4, 16 possible ontic states of the entire system. So that means that it's going to take 4 binary questions to specify the exact ontic state. Each time you ask a binary question, you divide the state space into 2. So by the knowledge balance principle, you're going to be able to know the answer to at most 2 of those questions, and then the other 2 you should be completely ignorant about. But there's a subtlety here, which is that we want to apply the knowledge balance principle not just to the global system, but also to the individual toy bits. Okay, so each toy bit, its ontic state is specified by 2 questions, and I must only know the answer to at most 1 of those. And the global system as well, I can only know the answer to two questions about the global system. Right, so in particular, so now what I'm doing, so previously I was, these four boxes are the state of one system, but now what I'm doing is I'm arranging these in a row so that I can write out the ontic states of system A along the horizontal here. They correspond to the different columns here, and for B along the vertical. So for example, although this kind of state where you have 25% probability in each of these boxes satisfies the global knowledge balance principle, it doesn't satisfy it for system B, because for system B, I know the exact ontic state of system B. Okay, but I shouldn't. I should know as much about system B as I don't know. Right. So you have to take care. You have to look at all the ontic states, all the epistemic states that satisfy the global knowledge balance principle, and then look at the marginals and take care that they apply, that the knowledge balance principle applies to those as well. So I'm not going to write out all of the epistemic states. There are quite a lot of them. But note that they come in two classes. So of the two valid epistemic states, some of them are just products of independent distributions on the two toy bits. Right, so this is like an X tensor X state where you know exactly the X value, the value of an X measurement of toy bit A and of toy bit B. And you can draw other states which are like that for different combinations, go through all of them if you like. But then there are some states which are correlated, and those are going to be the analogs of entangled states. Okay, so something like this is fine, right? So knowing half the questions globally means that I know that the system is in one of four boxes, so that's okay. But also the marginals of this, right? What do I know about which row it's in? Well, I'm completely mixed, so that's allowed by the knowledge balance principle. And they're also completely mixed over the columns, right? So anything that looks like these sorts of things will obey the knowledge balance principle both locally and globally. And these kind of things always have uniform marginals, right? So this is the reason why the only mixed state in the toy theory for a single qubit is the maximally mixed one, because it has to be a marginal of something that looks like this. All right, so now reversible dynamics, there's a complication when you consider joint systems again, which is that not all permutations are going to be allowed anymore, because some of them will map a valid epistemic state to an invalid one. Right, so example, this permutation here, if I just switch these two boxes, switch these two boxes, switch these two boxes, and leave everything else alone, that would map this correlated state to this thing, which we already saw was not a valid epistemic state. Right. So you have to work out which permutations are allowed for the joint system. There's two ways to do it, the hard way and the easy way. Hard way is using what I've told you so far, write out every single epistemic state in the theory, write down a permutation, and just check on a case-by-case basis which ones, whether it maps everything to a valid state. There's an easier way, which is if you use the phase space formalism for this, then the valid transformations are exactly the symplectic transformations on that phase space, right? So if you don't know what that means, that's phase space terminology. And if you look in that paper that I mentioned at the beginning, which does it in that formalism, that gives you a much easier way to see what the valid permutations are. Okay, so now let's look at some of the explanations that are possible in this theory. EPR is now like easy. So the EPR experiment works just as EPR expected it would in this kind of theory. So this theory is deterministic. The ontic state determines exactly the outcomes of X, Y, Z measurements, everything that you can do in the theory. So the outcomes of the measurements are indeed all predetermined, as EPR argued they should be. The two systems are initially in a correlated probability distribution, which accounts for the fact that you get correlated outcomes to your experiments. And the collapse of the wave function is just updating of your information, although remember that when you make a measurement, there's a disturbance, followed by a local randomization of the system being measured, right? So only the system that you're measuring has to get disturbed, not the other ones. There's no non-local effect going on here. So here's an example. If this is the correlated state that you start with, then if you measure system A in, do the X measurement on system A, that distinguishes these two columns apart, okay? So the plus X outcome is this column, minus X outcome is that column. Okay, so if you get plus X, if you happen to get plus X, then you know you were in this column. So if you just updated your information, you'd say, I should have drawn dark blue squares here because these are probability half. But you know it's either in this box or that box. But then remember that on system A, when I make that measurement, the two ontic states that give me the plus outcome for X, they get randomized, okay? So here are those two ontic states. So if I get the plus outcome, then either these things stays in the same place, or with probability half, they get switched, and similarly all the way up here. So this epistemic state will end up in like this, which is just the product state X tensor X, right? So now you see that I started in an entangled state, and I ended up in a product state. That's basically the what's going on with the collapse of the wave function in this theory. Of course, we know that ultimately it can't be like this because of Bell's theorem. But this is at least to show you that for the EPR case, it works out nicely.
So this cannot be I think that was an important point, but
it's an important point.
I'm not sure that I understood it.
I mean, this theory is local in the sense that each system has its own ontic state, and the dynamics, you know, when I do something on system A, that just, you know, permutes or acts on the system A degrees of freedom and has no effect on system B, right? So this is a local theory. So you know, well, the EPR paradox by itself isn't enough to establish Bell's theorem, right? So this works, but Bell correlations are not going to work, of course. Here's another thing. So in quantum theory, you know that a mixed state has multiple decompositions into pure states. But that's true here as well. So this maximally mixed state where you have no knowledge about the system could be written as an equal mixture of the X states, an equal mixture of the Y states, or an equal mixture of the Z states. And the reason why this can happen is that in this theory, a pure state, what we quantumly think of as a pure state, is a spread out distribution. And things that correspond to non-orthogonal pure states overlap, right? So this has this state, has this ontic state in common with between these two. So only if I have that feature could I possibly reproduce this kind of thing with classical probability distributions. Like things that represent non-orthogonal quantum states have to overlap. And that's basically what we mean by the theory being psi epistemic. This is another very easy one now, indistinguishability of pure states. So if I have two pure states in quantum theory, say plus X and plus Y, then I know that there's no measurement that will distinguish them with certainty. There's no measurement that tells me if I prepare plus X or plus Y, there's no measurement I can do that will say, that will reliably tell me which one happened. In this theory, it's very simple to see why, because of this overlap, right? So if I prepare plus X or plus Y, sometimes the state of reality is exactly the same. Right? So any measurement you do is only sensitive to what the state of reality is. Right? So a measurement that attempts to distinguish this from this must fail at least 50% of the time, fail to do so at least 50% of the time, because 50% of the time, the state of reality is actually the same. So this is what we mean by the psi epistemic explanation of indistinguishability. It will be important in a couple of lectures' time. That's very straightforward. No cloning theorem, also very straightforward. It's a similar kind of reasons. So here is the state of toy bit, and this is the plus x state, and this is the plus y state. Now, I imagine, suppose there was some physical transformation that could give me two copies of x and two copies of y if I inputted x or y. Now you see what happens. Over here, these two states are occupied 50% of the time, regardless of whether I prepare plus x or plus y. Okay, so 50% of the time, I have exactly the same state of reality. But over here, in the cloned state, the only overlap is this square and this square, and that occurs 25% of the time. So if there were a cloning map, I would have gone from a situation where 50% of the time the ontic state is the same to a situation where only 25% of the time the ontic state is the same. But that can't possibly happen, because whatever this map does, it has to do the same thing to this ontic state. The device that you put this thing into will only see the state of reality. It won't see your probability distribution. It'll just see what's the state of reality. So 50% of the time, regardless of whether this is a deterministic transformation or a stochastic transformation, 50% of the time, the cloning, your purported physical, any physical map, has to do the exact same thing to this state as to this state, right? Yeah.
Why can't I just devise a machine which in the case plus plus for 50% of the cases does this and 50% of the cases does something else?
Yeah, so that would then be an imperfect cloning machine, right? So even in quantum theory, we can have an imperfect cloning machine which works with some probability and fails otherwise. We can have that. We can have, you can have unambiguous cloning. You can have approximate cloning in quantum theory. So you could do that here as well, of course. What you can't have is cloning with certainty, like in quantum theory. So again, this is the explanation. The explanation is in terms of the overlap. The amount of overlap between probability distributions can't go down in any physical transformation. So again, having overlap between non-orthogonal states is what gets you this idea. Okay, so now we're going to move on to something that's a little bit more challenging. So it's surprising how many people say, yes, this toy theory stuff is all well and good, but of course you can't have interference in it, because it's just a classical probabilistic model. So obviously no interference. But that's totally wrong. I mean, hopefully you guys are very sophisticated and you can see it's obvious that there's interference. But I want to go through this in a little bit of detail to show you that basically you can get exactly the Feynman interference kind of paradoxes or the Elitzer-Weidman bomb, and it's completely unmysterious in this kind of model. Okay, so the first thing we need to do this properly is we need to move to, in the quantum description, to like the second quantized or optical mode type description or Fock-space description, depending on the way you looked at it. So in lecture one, when I looked at this, I said we had a two-dimensional state space of single photon states. Either the photon is in this mode or it's in that mode, and I had these two states. But we can sort of decompose that in the sort of quantum field theory style and instead say, no, each of these two things is an optical mode which can have some arbitrary number of photons in it. Okay, so in particular, mode zero has a vacuum state where it has no photons. It has a one photon state, has two photon states, etc. as well. But we won't worry about those because we're going to stick to the subspace in which there's at most one photon in each mode. Similarly, mode two, this one can have zero photons, one photon, two, etc. So what I previously wrote as zero, which I meant a photon in mode zero, would now be written like this, one photon in mode zero, zero photons in mode one, and one, which means a photon in this mode would be zero photons in mode zero, one photon in mode one. Okay, so that's the mapping to the new description. So now, if I stick to the 0-1 subspace, whereas previously I described this as a single qubit, now I'm going to be describing it as two qubits, and it will be two qubits if I restrict to states with it, which have at most one photon in each mode. Okay, so now remember what happens at a 50-50 beam splitter. In the old notation, it was this, but in the new notation, it's going to be this, right? And the key thing here is that in this new description, the beam splitter is an entangling operation. Here, this is only partially specified. I have to tell you what happens to the 0-0 and the 1-1 states as well, but we're not going to worry about that. It doesn't matter for the what follows. So then detectors, so detectors now are going to act as a local measurement on this tensor product space, right? So when I put a detector on mode zero, I'm going to do this projective measurement, zero versus one. And what I mean by the detector clicking is I get the 1-1 outcome, right? So I can independently put detectors on mode zero and mode one, and they detect and they click if you detect this answer. I'm not going to worry about the description of mirrors because, as you've seen, having two mirrors in the Mach Zehnder just has the effect of putting a global phase on everything, which isn't physically relevant. So you could do it, but it's just will add unnecessary extra time. Okay, so now let's look at the toy theory model of this. So here's my Mach Zehnder interferometer. So basically, I have two qubits. Okay, so that means I'm going to use a model which has two toy bits. One toy bit represents the degrees of freedom which travel along mode zero, and the other toy bit represents the degrees of freedom which travel along mode one, this way. Okay, so what I'm going to do, I have to make a mapping, just make a mapping from the pure states in my quantum description to the pure states in the toy theory. So a vacuum state, I'm going to model as the minus x state in the toy theory, so just this. And a single photon state, I'm going to model as the plus x, a minus x plus x. Okay, so when I take a Mach Zehnder interferometer and I put a single photon in mode zero, no photons in mode one, then that corresponds to this state, which in the toy theory is just this, right? So the first degree of freedom tells you the x value. So we know that mode zero has plus x, so it's one of these two states, and mode one has minus x, so it's one of these two states. So the intersection of those are these four boxes, so that's the initial product state that we're using. Now what we have to do is model the beam splitter. The beam splitter in quantum theory is a unitary entangling interaction. Beam splitters only happen when the two modes are together, so they're allowed to interact, the two degrees of freedom. So what we're going to do is use this permutation. So we swap the far corners and we swap the diagonals of the square in the middle. Now, you have to, in principle, check that that is a valid permutation in the toy theory. Has to satisfy the knowledge balance principle. So I'm not going to go through it, but you can check that, well, either by checking it's a symplectic transformation on phase space or by going through every epistemic state and checking it gives you a valid one. That is a valid permutation in the theory. Okay, so what does this do? Well, if I start with my initial Mach Zehnder state, it's going to swap these two and swap these two. The other diagonals don't matter because they're not occupied. So that's going to give me this correlated state. And this correlated state is what I want you to think of as the analog of this entangled state. So then after that, after we're in this probability distribution, the toy bit, the ontic degrees of freedom associated with mode zero, they just travel down the zero arm of the interferometer, and the mode one toy bit travels down the one arm. Okay. So what happens if there is no, let's assume that there's no detectors on the paths here? Well, remember I'm ignoring the mirrors. So the first beam splitter just maps me to this state. And then the second beam splitter, because this is this permutation is its own inverse, right? So it's just going to map me back to the original state. So I will always end up in a state in which the photon is in beam zero. Okay, in real math sender that we did before, it was always beam one, but the qualitative effect is the same. So if I do this, and I put detectors here and here, I will always with certainty find it in beam zero. We have a constructive type of interference. All right, so now what happens if I put in a detector? So let's suppose I put in a detector in mode one. That detector could be an Elitzer-Weidman bomb if you want, and it, maybe it blows up if the photon hits it, but it doesn't matter. It's like, it's the same effect. So the first beam splitter is going to work just as before. It'll map this to this. But now we do a measurement in mode one. So in mode one, we're going to distinguish whether we're in this row from whether we're in this row. So let's suppose we find the minus outcome, which means that this detector doesn't click, right? It means that the photon's actually up here. So this is like the Elitzer-Weidman bomb case where we don't see a click in the detector. What will happen then in the toy theory? Well, first of all, you'll learn that the photon was on the upper path. So that means, well, you'll learn that there's no photon on this path. So that means that you're in these one of these two minus states here, which have minus x for the mode one description. Okay, so if you just purely updated your information, you would rule out these two states, and you'd end up in an epistemic state like this. But then remember the act of measurement disturbs the ontic state of the degrees of freedom down here. So in order to respect the knowledge balance principle, we have to exchange with 50% probability the two states that have the minus outcome for x and the two states which have the plus outcome for x. So this is just the local permutation of those two. That leaves us in this state, which, look, is just the same as the initial state here, right? So you end up, after learning that this detector didn't click, you end up in the initial state that you started in. So then your second beam splitter will map you again back to this state, right? And now, if I make a measurement on either of the two output beams, there'll be 50-50 probabilities. Because if we look at this ontic, if we look at system mode zero, for instance, I have equal probability of being in each possible column. Half of those have plus x, and half of those have minus x. Okay, so the same is true on both. I'll get 50-50 probabilities. And because of the correlations, you can see that if I put two detectors, if one of them clicks, the other one doesn't, and vice versa, because this is basically in a single photon subspace. Okay, so that's exactly what goes on in Mach-Zehnder, so it's not really that mysterious. So the point of this is that a large number of apparently strange, so we've discussed a number of apparently strange phenomena in the first lecture or so. They're accounted for, at least qualitatively, you get the same effects in the toy theory. Quantitatively, too, when I go to higher dimensions and I have that this toy theory really reproduces whole sub-theories of quantum theory. The reason this can occur is because the theory is psi-epistemic. So as I explained, pure states are states of incomplete knowledge. They don't tell you the exact ontic states. And non-orthogonal pure states, they correspond to overlapping probability distributions. And that easily accounted for things like the non-uniqueness of mixed state decompositions, indistinguishability, and no cloning. For the interference, for Mach-Zehnder, there was another important thing that was playing a role. Okay, so the vacuum state is just a quantum state. So if you think that the quantum state is a state of knowledge, right, if it represents a probability distribution, and if non-orthogonal states should represent overlapping probability distributions, then the vacuum necessarily in an underlying ontological model has to correspond to a spread out distribution over several possible ontic states. Okay, so that means that you can't have a description in which when one mode is in the vacuum, that there's nothing there, right? There has to be more than one possible ontic state corresponding to that. And what's going on here is that those degrees of freedom are able to mediate the information locally about whether or not there's a detector here over to the second beam splitter. But that's not like a contrived idea. It has to be the case if you believe that quantum states are states of knowledge and you believe that the vacuum is just another quantum state. Okay, so now that I've destroyed more or less everything that I said was weird in the first lecture, what we have to do is figure out what actually is strange and difficult to understand about quantum theory.
But it also does not prevent psiontic interpretation.
Yeah, so psiontic interpretations can exist, of course.
As long as we distinguish them with...
And they would have their own, they would have different kinds of explanations for this kind of phenomena. So in Bohmian mechanics, for instance, in Bohmian mechanics, the explanation for this is a bit different. It says that, okay, there's a wave that goes down both paths and that mediates the interaction as well as a particle. I think what's interesting here is that a lot of people say, a naive argument is, well, obviously classical probability distributions don't interfere. So a lot of people say that. And so they would say interference immediately rules out psi epistemic. So I think it is, important to, go through the details and show that that really isn't true. At least at the qualitative level where people say something like, Mach Zinder immediately rules out psi epistemic. It doesn't. So clearly you can have a psiontic explanations as well. They would be different. And we will discuss that a bit more when we talk about the reality of the quantum state. Okay. So now what I want to do is move on to a framework. If we're going to prove rigorous theorems about what can and can't exist in reality, then we need a framework for talking about realist theories. There's always going to be some realist theories, usually the many worlds theory, which doesn't fit into it. It's hard to write down a framework which encompasses every different wrinkle that people think of. But there is a sort of a broad framework that people work in that does cover things like Bohmian mechanics, these psi epistemic theories, that we can formulate them in and then prove theorems about them. Okay, so if you remember, I think it was in lecture 2, I said that in general, an operational description of physics should involve some set of variables that we can control, knob settings and things like that, and some other variables that we observe. And an operational theory, its goal is to just predict these joint probability distribution of the things that we observe, given the settings that we make. Now, I'm going to break down the ontological models framework a little bit. This may be considered a little bit overkill, but because people often violently object to the ontological models framework for some reason, I really want to make it clear what assumptions are going in here. So the first assumption is fairly mild. It says, well, there's some addition, so there are the operational variables, the things that we can see, the things that we can control, right? It just says, well, maybe there's some additional stuff out there, okay? Maybe there is some underlying state of reality which might be the ontic, you know, in this Beckens toy theory, that as I was talking about the exact box that you're in, right? So let's denote those additional physical properties by lambda, and we say that they're a set of possible values, which is big lambda. So lambda is called the ontic state. Big lambda is called the ontic state space. It's all we're saying so far is there might be some additional things that we don't see directly. There's no restriction on what lambda could be at this stage, right? Lambda could be some set of particle trajectories in space-time. It could be, I don't know, positions and momenta in phase space. It could be field configurations. It could be quantum states, if you like psiontic. It could be green aliens on Mars, like really, right? Anything that I can write down mathematically can be lambda. There's no restriction going on here. There is one restriction, which if you're a mathematically oriented person, you may care about, which is that this needs to be a measurable space, because I'm going to put probabilities on it in a minute. But that's it. Okay, so then, this is the formulation of realism that we're going to use here, single world realism. So each time I run this experiment and observe these variables, all of the operational variables, so the A, B, C, D's, and these U, V, W's, all of those operational variables and lambda each take one single definite value on each run of the experiment. Okay, that's what makes this into single world interpretation. So in many worlds, the ontology, the fundamental ontology isn't correlated with the outcomes in this kind of way. We will discuss that later. And then this is just, you know, a statistical independence assumption. Each time I can run this experiment in such a way that I can find several regions of space-time that look like this and run the experiment on them, and I'm going to assume that I can do so in such a way that they're going to be statistically independent, in a sense of probabilistic independence. Okay, so those two things together just imply that this joint probability distribution must exist, right? Because I could just take the relative frequency distributions of the operational variables and the ontic states, right? That thing exists necessarily by these assumptions. Okay, so that's all that I mean by realism, really. I personally think that's relatively, I mean, there are assumptions in there, but I think that's relatively mild. That's all I mean by realism, nothing more than that. Okay, so at least for the next three lectures or so, we will be considering a very simple kind of experiment, which is a prepare and measure experiment. Okay, so that looks like this. At some point, you choose a variable P, which is a preparation variable. At some later point, you choose a variable M, which is setting of a measurement device, and then you see some outcome. Okay, so it's something that looks roughly like this in space-time, but we often sort of draw it in a more laboratory style like this. Right? So the idea is you have some preparation device. This is some device which has a knob that you can tune to different settings. And then at some point you start the experiment, it spits out a physical system which goes into this measurement device. This measurement device has a bunch of different settings, and then it displays the outcome K on a screen. Okay, so that's sort of laboratory-wise what we're thinking of these kinds of experiments are. Okay, so P is a choice of preparation, M is a choice of measurement, K is the outcome of the measurement. So then in this case, the operational theory should predict these probabilities. Okay, so then if we have ontic states and we have this single world realism and the independence, then we know that there's a joint probability distribution with whatever these additional degrees of freedom are. I want to make a point of notation here. When I write down a probability that's accessible operationally, right, that's in terms of just the variables that you can see, I usually write prob. And when I write something that refers also to ontic variables, I usually write PR, right? So PR refers to sort of the ontological description, and prob refers to operational description. Okay, so then this reproduces the operational predictions just in case, when I marginalize this thing over lambda, I should get back the probabilities of the operational theory, obviously. There's a reason why I'm using integrals instead of sums here, because you can prove, and we'll prove next time, that it's necessary even for a finite dimensional system that lambda has a continuum, has the cardinality of the continuum. And I also want to say that if I were being really rigorous, I would use proper mathematicians' measure theory. And I have a long review article on this, which does that, if you care about that. Here I'm going to adopt, more or less, I don't want to lose anyone, so I'm adopting sort of physicists' rigor about probability distributions. All right, so we have this. And in general, we can just use, you know, the law of total probability to decompose this probability distribution in this way, right? So move the lambda onto the right, condition on the lambda, then I've got to multiply by the probability of lambda given Pn. That's just probability theory says I can do that. Okay, so now, in order to get to the proper ontological models framework, I have to introduce two more assumptions, which are conditional independence assumptions. So basically, in a prepare and measure experiment, we want to think of this lambda as representing the physical properties of the system, right? Lambda represents the properties that the system actually has, right? That's how we want to conceptualize on it. So we introduce two assumptions. This one that says that this distribution doesn't actually depend on the measurement, okay? So if you read the literature on this stuff, this is often motivated as either a free choice assumption, a free will assumption, or a no retrocausality assumption. The idea being that you can, you know, you can do your preparation, and the state of the system is whatever it is. At some later time, you choose the measurement outcome. And the idea is that there should be nothing stopping you setting the measurement setting completely independently of whatever's going on with the physical system. Right, I could use some randomness from some completely external source to choose n, right? I could use a quantum random number generator as they do in Bell experiments. There's a recent Bell experiment, in fact, where they used the fluctuations of distant stars in the Milky Way, right? The point is that you can set it in a way that it would be very implausible if the properties of the system actually depended on that. So that's that assumption which is always made and is true of theories like Bohmian mechanics, if you care. Okay, then the second assumption is lambda mediation, which says that this part here shouldn't depend on the preparation. So the idea is that if you really want to say that lambda represents the physical properties of the system, and I'm doing an experiment on the system, right? So preparation device prepares system. System then goes into measurement device, right? We don't want there's some other way of correlating the preparation and measurement. There shouldn't also be a telephone wire connecting the preparation and measurement that makes the measurement outcome correlated with the preparation in some other way than via the properties of the system. It's the properties of the system alone that are doing that. So to me, this is part of the definition of what we mean by ontic state of the system. It's pretty silly to have a notion of ontic state of the system that isn't responsible for any correlations you see between different devices that act on the system. Okay, so you can debate these principles ad infinitum if you want. Are they reasonable? Are they not reasonable? You can certainly have that discussion. But if you impose those assumptions, then you'll get a decomposition like this. So that's what we mean by an ontological model. So an ontological model is a model where you have some ontic states. They could be completely trivial. It could be just a singleton set, so that's not really saying much. You have some ontic states. It satisfies this single world realism. I can do experiments independently of each other. I have measurement independence. I have lambda mediation. That's what we mean by an ontological model. It's a whole bunch of assumptions that I think they're all pretty mild. But there's another way of saying it. In other words, there's an ontic state space associated to my system. Each preparation P gets assigned a probability distribution over lambda. Each measurement gets assigned this conditional probability distribution that tells me the probability of the measurement outcome given that I've made measurement M and that the ontic state is lambda. And then that should reproduce the operational predictions. Okay, so that's what we mean by an ontological model. Okay, so far I've been abstract, right? I just talked about preparations in the abstract as things that you do in the lab. Of course, often and usually we're interested in experiments that are well described by quantum theory. We're interested in the properties of quantum mechanical experiments. So to the same operational theory, we can at least try to assign a quantum model. So in a quantum model, you assign a Hilbert space to the system. Each preparation will now be associated with a density operator, quantum state, each measurement with a P over M, and the operational predictions should we also expect to be reproduced by the Born rule, the quantum probabilities. And if that's the case, we have a quantum model in mind, then the predictions of the ontological model should agree with the quantum predictions. This is important because it's, you know, this can get confusing, right? So I'm going to tell you about something which I will do sometimes, which is an extremely naughty thing to do. So in general, there are going to be many different ways of preparing the same quantum state. Even if you have a pure state, there are different physical procedures I can do to prepare the same pure state, right? So if I'm preparing a qubit in, say, preparing a spin the half particle in up spin x state, I can put it through a Stern-Gerlach magnet oriented in the x direction, block one of the output channels. I could also rotate the Stern-Gerlach magnet by 180 degrees and block the other output channel. Those are different physical procedures, but they prepare the same quantum state, right? And when you have mixed states, it's even worse than that, because I can prepare a mixed state by, a mixed state has many decompositions into pure states, and so I can prepare it in multiple different ways by flipping coins and preparing pure states. So in general, many physical operations in the lab, many P's will correspond to the same quantum state, and similarly, many measurement procedures will correspond to the same P over M. So nothing I've said so far implies that if you have two preparations that correspond to the same density operator, that they have to have the same probability distribution, or we sometimes call epistemic state, in the ontological model. Nor does it imply that that if you have the same P over M element corresponding to a measurement outcome pair, that these probabilities have to be the same. As we'll discuss next time, this is a version of non-contextuality to say that. So it would be extremely naughty to write your probabilities like this, right? Where these probabilities only depend on the P over M element and these only depend on the quantum state. Nonetheless, sometimes I'll do that where it doesn't matter, right? So if I'm, because it's sometimes just painful to consider, okay, I've got operational theory, I've got quantum model, I've got ontological model, and you've got sort of three things you've got to juggle. So if I write something like this, it means I'm implicitly considering only one particular way of preparing each quantum state and one particular way of implementing a measurement. Or sometimes what I need to say about these things is independent of the way of implementing it, in which case I may write it like that, just for simplicity. Okay, so the next thing to do is to go through some examples, but I think we're out of time, so we will do that at the beginning of next time. Any questions? Yeah.
In the toy model, so like, I don't know if this is a valid question, but so you had this, you can attribute the toy bit to a system, And in one case, you showed that it could be a photon or not a photon in the modes.
Right.
So is it meaningful to ask, because we have disturbances of the ontic state, how does energy come into the picture? So like we have a photon or we don't, which is an energetic thing. But in the ontic state of the toy bit, it seems it doesn't matter what the system represents in terms of energy, and the disturbance is always the same.
Right, so we're primarily looking at the just the informational properties of things, but you know, you could certainly, right, if I have, you know, so if I have a pure state which corresponds to two possible ontic states, if it's an energy eigenstate, then you could certainly think, okay, these underlying ontic states have the same energy in some sense, right? And certainly in the sense that if I measured energy on them, I would get the same, right? So If I have those two ontic states in the vacuum state and we've normalized things such that energy of the vacuum is zero, then a permutation of those is just exchanging two states with the same energy. Now, in thermodynamics, you can do that with no thermodynamic cost. Now, there is the fact that when I do these measurement disturbances, there's a mixing going on in the underlying, right? So, if I were to just use classical thermodynamics, then I would say, oh, entropy should increase, but in the quantum description, entropy hasn't increased. Really, you have to think of thermodynamics. And by the way, there was a recent paper by Adam Cabello and people like that where they claim that ontological models must involve a huge amount of heat generation for this kind of reason. But they're totally wrong, because thermodynamics is about operationally accessible quantities, right? So it's about, there's an operational definition of the entropy, which would be the von Neumann entropy. So providing my theory exactly reproduces the predictions of quantum mechanics, it's going to have the same thermodynamic implications, right? Because operationally they'll be indistinguishable. So there may be funny things going on at the underlying ontological level, but you know, it's the operational predictions that matter for how you do thermodynamics and energy conservation and things like that. Okay, thanks everyone.